if you want an interesting framework for this, which is really challenging for us now, because we don't do any of this nowadays, at least our Beit Din. Right, people come in for a get, we write the get. But in Chayin Grada's Yaguna, which I recommend to everybody, we don't put barriers to divorce. Right, in cases where people decide to divorce, we don't deliberately. It's interesting. We just had a case where we had a lot of. I think there'll be some thought about whether we should have, whether we should. When there's already been a civil divorce, there's no issue at all. The problem is that nowadays couples often come in for the get first, because each of them is afraid that the other one will eventually be misarif. And in those cases, conceivably, you shouldn't write the get immediately, for two reasons. One is because maybe they shouldn't get divorced. And two is because getting divorced raises all sorts of immediate problems in terms of the children. Because you're because of yichud and negiah and all sorts of things like that. So there, right? So that's a really interesting question, right? There are good reasons.
The assumption is that they're still going to be married to each other in time.
They're not civilly divorced right. Yet.
Oh, yeah, I'm saying like they're still going to act like they're married even when they're halachically married, even if they're.
Well, if they were halachically married, right, then they don't have these issues, right?
Right.
Then they can sleep overnight in the same house with the kids, right? Right.
So the assumption is they're going to continue doing that until they get the civil divorce, even
that's
once
right.
They're halachically divorced. Okay.
Right. You create all sorts of, right? You've created an immediate economic burden. They have to have two houses. Right, when you write, so that's a real question whether we should revisit that policy and think about there are certain cases where if a couple comes in, what we should do instead is just have the husband write the get and give it to us and not actually carry out the get. That's an interesting question. We have always just written the get. On the other hand, sometimes the husband isn't willing to do that unless,
if they're concerned about mutual seiruv. Right, then.
Once he writes
the get, meaning the possibility still exists that she could be misarevus.
Yes, it leaves the husband much more vulnerable. So it's a hard thing.
Also, once he writes it and gives it to you, he can't take and she hasn't accepted it yet. Is it too late for him to take it back?
We tell the shliach has to avoid him. He can't do it shlo b'fanav.
Okay.
The shliach has to avoid him.
Try to make them not think they can.
Yeah.
Because it just creates problems.
It does. It does. Yeah, we had one case where we did that, and the husband did at some point think about creating problems. And so it's a whole issue. We're very careful never to let the husband actually say it. The husband kind of make sure never actually let the husband say, I wish to be involved with the shliach. No matter what he said, I'm not sure I want to get divorced. Okay, I'm not sure you want to get divorced. But you're very careful not to let him say the magic words. But I think that's a real challenge. This is a case that come home to me more recently that the get creates immediate problems in ways that it wouldn't. But in all my experience, there have been I think two, maybe three couples now it's like 14 years or something like that in which we have actually tried to talk them out of getting the divorce, and we failed both times.
What kinds of reasons would prompt you to do that or you don't want?
So the case I always talk about, or the one case still haunts me, is this beautiful Israeli couple that came in and it behaves with each other exquisitely and with enormous mutual respect. Like, late 20s, and they've been together since they were 15 or 16 and married for like 5 years. And we asked them, why are you getting divorced? And they said, because the spark is gone and we want it to end it before the memories turn bitter. And I was looking at them and said, go take a vacation together. Mm-hmm. And this is we're looking what are the odds you're ever going to be this happy again? It was just tragic. And so, I just couldn't do it, right? I think I was the young and naive rabbi, so Rabbi Helfinger let me take them into a room somewhere and talk to them and other, but that was their decision. I hope that they're happy. It was. I was just devastated.
Yeah, I was. Telling that marriage is about love. It's about loyalty and relationship.
No, we didn't say that. Marriage is about love, and you have it. You're just right. You don't have the. You don't have it at exactly the same fever pitch you had three. You had 3 years ago. So go get it back. It was. all of us have seen enough people afterwards, and so not so many. Some people are happier because the marriage is a bad marriage, but not some people. Many people are in a good marriage or happier after divorce. So that's the only. But the reason I was building it, but in Chaim Grada Ziaguna, so he tells you that the rabbi appointed in charge of divorce in Vilna, his job was to make sure that, right, he was designed to function like your worst nightmare, the registry of motor vehicles. No, I'm sorry, we're closed today. Right? Yes, that's really interesting. In 6 months, I have an opening, and you can come back and tell me this again. And that was his job, to right? The way Zori Grada presents it, but he would just delay divorce, until people just gave up in frustration.
That sounds so. Rabbi Breud once talked about these things, and he said that like the Vilna Beit Din kept track of how many people got divorced, but it was very few people.
Well, that's it. You know, if Grad is right, that's why.
It sounds like they had him, so that's what they
have to go to, like, I don't know, some other town. And
yeah, like, we
like
do
the
worry.
Divorce equivalent of Cyprus.
We do. Yeah, we do worry. I worry Sharon. Sharon has a what feels to me subjectively like a frightening divorce rate. That could
Jews.
Among Orthodox Jews, among members of my shul. It's just, you know, it's interesting. I walk around the room and I say, you know, I was at your get,
your gear.
That's the worst. Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, not so rarely both. So that's, and I don't know, like, you know, it's scary to me.
But,
or people are attracted to a certain kind of shul, right? You know, it's a shul that, you know, that maybe, I don't know. Or maybe it's just subjective, because I know the people, right? Where other people come in, I don't know which shul they daven in.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we talk about that, like, you know, is there a way, there's lots of rumors about Orthodoxy and divorce rates. And I don't think there's any really good sociology. I don't think articles in the Stern Observer count. As,
okay.
Maybe there's some.
It's also like hard. It's very hard to tell for like lay people on a shul who's married and who's divorced if you're not like if you don't have your ear to gossip.
Yeah, no, but it's a problem. Like, you know, because people always cover all these trends, right? So if you have 3-4 friends who broke engagements, you think there's a crazy trend of broken engagements, and maybe 3-4 friends who go. And it's reasonable anecdotal evidence, but you don't know. You don't, you know, it might just be sunspots. You know, that over a 30-year period, there are ups and downs, and that just happens. I don't know. I would like to see a good longitudinal study of, and we've talked about a Beit Din anyway that we can commission, you know, a longitudinal study of marriage and divorce rates in the Orthodox community, and to what extent it's affected by age of marriage. To what extent it's affected by premarital counseling with a shul rabbi, right? What these factors are, because we don't have any. But so I was always fascinated by this figure in Vilna, in the Chaim Grada's thing, whose whole purpose is to keep people from getting divorced, and that's why they pick him. They pick him because he's the rabbi of the devil, and he, of course, is a terrible marriage.
Well, if that's what he's like, if
you
honest.
Wanted to get a divorce.
No, it's what he's the model, right? Whatever that people tell him about what they're suffering, well, you know, it's not like me.
Also, I mean, if that's what he's like, you know, at his work, he's probably not exactly, you know, thrilled to be around.
No, he's a tzaddik. Of course he's a tzaddik.
He's a tzaddik who happens to be in a marriage that isn't great.
Right, also his daughter is insane and continually gets undressed in public.
Is this a novel?
So she's on the level of Adam and Chava.
Well, that's what she keeps saying. It's a terrifying novel, but worth everyone. I always talk the reason to read it.
There was an actual crazy guy in Europe who, like, probably
all of Grada's characters are. I mean, they're all real stories, right? They're told through a lens, but they're all real. They're all real stories. Or one of his. This is Kosel Shulyud, right? This is not Kosel. It's Kosel Yud is someone else's thing. But this is a real case of an aguna with his husband disappeared. And I always I encourage all my students to read it because it's he invents one of the great phrases of Yiddish literature, the Shaul Solotra complex. The Shaul Solotra complex are people who go through life wanting to make Kiddush and Shul and Yom Kippur. right? Because they're looking for the occasion where they come up with the really with the apparently transgressive thing, which is really a mitzvah. Right, so the anti-hero of the novel is the rabbi who is matir the aguna when none of his colleagues go along, because he suffers from Yisrael Salander complex and it ruins everyone's life, because he loses his parnasa, and the man who's willing to marry the aguna can't deal with it and leaves her, and she goes insane and commits suicide, and the whole gamut all because he has Yisrael Salander complex. And it's really powerful because you expect Grada to be this liberal who thinks that, thinks that that's the hero, and it's not.
This book is in Yiddish.
It wasn't Yiddish. Now it's in English. Now it's translated. So as well as a lot of comments, it hit home for me very much. As usual, I tell a story here, but a story I love telling about myself. But one year when I was rabbi at Brandeis, I was late to shul on Yom Kippur morning for reasons that were not necessarily worthy. And I walked into shul, and a fellow came to me and said, "Don't worry, Rabbi, we know why you were late, because it was because you were up all night chopping wood for a little old lady who would have died of cold otherwise." I said to him, "I wish, but unfortunately not so, but if you want me to make Kiddush." all right.
Salander is the one who came late for shul on Yom Kippur because he was drunk.
No, because he was chopping wood for a little lady. But that's
the story of Yom Kippur.
They're all the Yiddish writers are about real people, but then the stories move from person to person. Salander comes late because the baby doesn't show up in a Kol Nidre night because there's a baby crying and the mother left. Yeah. Right, the mother left.
In making of a god altar, there's like a whole discussion of like, what did Rabbi Yisrael Salander do
yes.
on Yom Kippur? It's a really big discussion.
It turns out that he went to
shul. Hey, David, he's fasted. It's all very disappointing. It was his evil twin brother, Skippy.
did he make Kiddush? Did he, like, provide hot tea? Were there cookies?
I think the historians argue that he gave a heter for some people to drink during a cholera epidemic and told them to make Kiddush.
And then maybe he did put on a show in shul to make sure that people would feel comfortable doing it.
Who knows? Who knows? I don't know.
Well, I'm making a god of his
fault. Yes. Okay. So Rav Moshe comes out, right? He says, "V'lachein laniyas dati yeshli spochel marik shorish kufim aleph arbi achronim shesovrim kimoso she'ein tzarech hetcher demei rabbanim be'uvda kazu she'grisha l'koin grisha l'koin v'lo kech sam sofer." So Rav Moshe ends up rejecting the chsam sofer as he understands it. But the chsam sofer is a lot more complicated than Rav Moshe presents. He rejects the chsam sofer's presentation of the notion that the key factor is whether she was poshe or not. And he says that that's not the key factor at all. The key factor is, do we want her to get divorced or not? If we want her to get divorced, then we don't require her to marry Rabbanim. If we don't want her to require her to get divorced, we do require her to marry Rabbanim. Okay, so now he says, V'rak b'shaha eser shonim v'lo yolda, but in the case of infertility, la'sovrin d'yesh l'hatir, according to those people who think it's mutter, v'rak b'mei Rabbanim, but lo mitam to lo pasha shehevi apischei tshuva, but not because it's not her fault. Ela mishum de lo bor ha-tzorech.
There's the Shev Yaakov
again. Yeah. As mishum de lo bor ha-tzorech, v'tzorech lodun v'chol uvda shemizdamim. But it's not like Sam Sofer said, it's not about Pshia. It's just because who knows what the reason, who knows whether we really need to do it in this case. Maybe they're not really infertile. Right, maybe he's really infertile, and so this won't do any good. Right? And nowadays, anyway, he says, right, even if you claim that Moshe wasn't goes to Bemakom Mitzvah, maybe Shah Eser Shanim isn't Bemakom Mitzvah. Kevan she'enu masa iser, because it's not doing anything aser, right? Goran lemnias haMitzvah. All you're doing is not fulfilling Puravu. Ovifrat she'en kofim mizmanazel leMitzvah zu, and since particularly we don't force people to get divorced nowadays anyway for infertility. Therefore, it makes sense for a minute, Gershom, even on the second approach, to say that we're going to make a special takana, that even after 10 years, there's Even after 10 years, there's a reason to require the Meir Rabbanim. And what about Roa Machmas Rachmas Tashvish? So that's the Machlokas. But Lo Pasha, he thinks, doesn't matter at all.
And here we're still talking about two wives in all of these cases.
Yes. But now he says, six lines above. And even in terms of divorcing her against the will, who tam dachuk, the whole rationale of fault doesn't make sense to him. Me'acher she'asur la'shosa, since since even women who are not at fault, it's asur to remain married to them, right? Because you're not allowed to remain married to somebody who you can't have a, let's assume, right, default setting, who you can't have a sexual relationship with at all. Again, we wouldn't, in most cases, right, we wouldn't compel divorce. We have no power to compel divorce nowadays anyway. We could talk about how norms have changed about that. Pardon?
At least in America, we can't compel divorce.
Where could we?
In Israel.
How do we compel him? You know, put him in jail? I don't think the Rabbanu, anyone will tolerate the Rabbanu taking away the passport of somebody who refuses to divorce his infertile wife.
Fine, infertile. But in general, you can sometimes force
him. Yeah, but not for this.
Okay.
Right? However, he says, right, he makes this new interesting claim. Three lines to the bottom, he says, "Val kevan shu davar b'seser, tov lahasrich kufra banim shlo yavo lahakil." Says, but if there are cases such as, right, women who are incapable of having a sexual relationship because of nida, leaving aside how we should react to such cases and whether we should ever tolerate, you know, whether medically that ever really happens nowadays in a way that isn't solvable and all that kind of things. So in such cases, since no one will know why, let's require a Meir Rabbanim anyway. Right? So he does the same thing as Chassam Sofer, which is, he says, Medina, there's no need for 100 Rabbanim because it's us, or we don't want it. But for public appearances, now we have to do it. And now he says, V'chein bezinsa be'ofen shloma fursam. If somebody, right, if a wife commits adultery secretly, we should require a Meir Rabbanim.
Well, not secretly enough that we didn't know about it. But
we know about it. But if it isn't known publicly, so we should require Meir Rabbanim, because otherwise people will think that you can be mocked people without Meir Rabbanim.
They don't actually know the real reason.
They don't actually know the real reason. But he says, in the case of Grusha LeKohen, everyone will know why, or if she publicly. So the end of Rav Moshe, what we have is what seems to me to be a radically new but very, very compelling perspective. Which is to say that we require Hetta Meir Rabbanim whenever we have an interest in forcing the person to think about whether he should divorce. We don't require Hetta Meir Rabbanim except, right, whenever we want the person to divorce unqualifiedly. But then he messes that up by saying, but we still require Hetta Meir Rabbanim in cases where we're afraid that other people will think that we didn't require Hetta Meir Rabbanim for insufficient reason. Now we could start making distinctions that maybe in those cases we won't require, right, those cases everyone will just tell people sign on the dotted line. We don't really want to say, right, because if it's really mutter, if a woman has committed znus, right, if she's asur, without hetter meir rabbanim, so now what do I have, now we have this problem of esotericism, right, so, shalom rabari, how are you doing today? Yes, I'd like you to sign a hetter meir rabbanim. Why? Well, because she burnt his stew. Rabbi, that doesn't make any sense at all. Yeah, shh. Really, she committed znus. We can't say that.
You just tell 100 people that and
then
everyone knows.
Right. Either, right? Everyone knows, or it looks bad. So I don't really know how, you know, this is one of the things where Moshe has a really interesting idea, but I don't really know how it plays out.
Also, since when are we concerned about, like, things that are punishable, that are occurring, that occur b'seser, remaining b'seser? Like, for example, like, case of meses, right?
Yeah.
Like, occurs baseser, kisisacha, etc. Baseser.
Yeah.
And we execute them quite publicly. So.
Yeah. So it's interesting. But, you know, so
I mean, is it just me like mitzah like divrei tznias or?
That's a really interesting question. Whether we're not talking about edim, right? There are no witnesses, right? We just know she committed znus. So the question is: do we have an interest in publicizing that a couple is getting divorced because of her adultery?
The husband might.
Or he might, it might go the other way. He may have it.
It's, yeah, it's true. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean,
right. Yeah.
Being
cuckolded. Yeah. So, I'm not sure. But I'm not sure that this thing, that this planet of emotion works at all. So I don't know what the Hetamerabunim looks like.
Do Heterim Demerabunim always come with a reason?
Yeah. They come with a fact statement. So it sounds like Rav Moshe is drilling a case with a fact statement. Now maybe Rav Moshe thinks that it can just stay among the rabbis and not get published. So this is, as in many areas of halacha, you can't do it, right? You try and keep things secret, but it's on the internet.
Someone's gonna take photos from Wikipedia.
Right.
It's gonna be Munach. It's gonna sit on the stender in the middle of the block for about 10 minutes, and then it's gonna be translated on Rabbi Yehuda's blog. The next day. Rabbi Josh
Yehuda. Yeah.
But that's exactly what happened.
Yes, I don't know. In general, Rav Moshe's tshuva, you know, I think, give a lot of credit to rabbis and an assumption that there should be, that other people will give credit to rabbis, and that's, you know, an interesting challenge. What if that's not true anymore? Maybe it never was true. What if it's not true anymore?
Maybe it was only true if you were Rav
Moshe. But that's a whole question.
He has 99 friends.
And, or what happens if it just depends on an assumption that it's possible to have a somewhat private rabbinic discourse, and that's not possible anymore. Sorry, so how do we affect halacha if we can't have private conversations anymore? And that's really a big issue. I think Rav Moshe still assumed that if you wrote in obscure enough Hebrew, that, you know, that things would stay fairly private. And there are people who argue, I think my wife told one of her teachers argued too, that tshuvos are written in. The reason for Rosh Tevos and Shavuos is to make sure that nobody will, right, that nobody who isn't part of the rabbinic elite will be able to read them.
Well, that may or may not be the intention. Sometimes
Rosh Tevo,
it could be. Look, so I'm undoing this, right? Just paragraphing, right? Makes, you know, and line breaking and punctuating makes an enormous difference. Mm-hmm. So that's right. So that's the whole. Well, that's Art Scroll, right? Art Scroll changes the world that way. I was just rereading something I wrote, you know, about Sefer Machla years ago. Like, you know, we've created a world where a 12-year-old, who, right, a bright 12-year-old, can just take books off the shelf and teach herself to learn Gemara. Right? That's right. That's a different world. Can't keep things secret anymore.
It's like the next
thing I should be learning Zohar. Well, now that Joel Hecker has finished the last volume, yeah.
Truly frightening.
No, the Pritzker Zohar, yeah.
Pritzker Zohar?
Pritzker. The Pritzker Zohar. Pritzker Zohar. The Pritzker Zohar, I think, is one of those jokes where you talk about, you know, that, but it's a very short book.
That's why I was confused.
There is, you know, there's masculinity, there's femininity, there's eminence, there's transcendence, there's shkinah, there's Pritzker Zohar. Enough of this poetry stuff. I can tease, by the way, teaser that what I am coming out with on Lehrer House in a few weeks is an attempt to present Yish HaLacha as poetry.
You have an hour to accomplish whatever you want to do today.
Thank you. We're going to get through this, truly. Okay. So what I want to just keep showing, though, is how policy issues keep showing up. Right? People reach what seem to be perfectly compelling halachic conclusions, and then don't follow them. Right? So Sofer came up with these two wild things that when we do and we don't require at the Merabanim, and Rav Moshe came up with this wholly new requirement. Okay. And on Mikol Makom, so now Rav Moshe comes up with something new. He says, on Mikol Makom, Tov L'Zakos L'Get. In this case of a Grusha L'Koin, now nobody's ever said this. Right? Nobody's ever suggested that. But we had a Moredes. Rav Moshe comes with this new idea. Let's do Get Zikoy by a woman who is Asura.
Because I guess the cases we had before was when she wasn't accessible.
Right.
And now is the assumption that she's not accessible, or is it just, let's do it anyway?
She doesn't want to do it. She won't take it. Right? She won't take it.
Right.
He's not being matir. Yeah, he's being matir two wives. He's not being matir Lagarsha Bal Korchat, right? It doesn't seem. So here's what he says. Even though she won't take the get because she says she doesn't care about halacha. And she's happy with the civil divorce. And she doesn't want to take the get because she is angry at him and she wants to mess him up. Mikol Makom says, nonetheless. This I think is just a great example of, you'll watch it and you'll see, tell me if you think this is too circular to fly or not. Okay, he says, really, you could be matir him without a get. Okay? And if she had known that he could be matir without a get, then she would take the divorce because it wouldn't be bad for him. So because if she thought that he could be, because we really could divorce him without a get, and if she knew that we could divorce, that we could let him be free without a get, then she would be want to take the get because it doesn't harm her. Therefore, even though we wouldn't actually free him without the get, we can give her the get as a schus.
We just said that we would free him without a get.
Ah, because we could.
But
we could free him without a get.
And that's with saying how.
So we give her a get zikui. Because even
so
though
she's not really without a get, it's just not.
That's right, right. Okay. So Rav Moshe says we should give her a get because we should give her a get zikui because even though she says she doesn't want it, that's only because she thinks she has power that way, and she doesn't really have power that way. So we'll give her the get, and that way we never
under
have to.
We can only give her the get without her consent if it's a get zikui.
That's right.
So but then she'd be okay with it.
It's not without her consent. We're going to give it through Zika. We're going to give it to somebody in Bezdin. Right?
Right. She would only wind up getting the get.
Yeah.
Via Zikoi. But then she'd be happy with it as she got it via Zikoi, even if she wouldn't want it before.
There's another way she'd be happy with it. No. Let's watch it again. He says is that really we should just let him remarry. And he can't get divorced because she won't take the get. But because we really should let him remarry, and if she knew that she would want the get, so. Now we can't.
What?
If she knew that we could let him free without the get,
I would explain Rav Moshe a little differently.
Yeah.
Okay. She is refusing to accept the get because she thinks that she's going to hurt him.
Uh huh.
However, what she doesn't know is that down the road she might meet someone who will only marry her if she has a kosher get.
Yeah.
She doesn't know this.
But he doesn't. That's not what the one Rav Moshe says.
She
wants to be bad to him.
No, but the next paragraph.
Yes, then it adds additional to it, because that wouldn't make it a schut, right? The schut is that she can remarry. The question is, how do we get rid of the fact that against that schut is that she wants to be mean to him?
Right. Well, she doesn't realize that from... We want to take a perspective where the get really is good for her,
mm-hmm.
and really it's almost meaningless for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that perspective, create an umdana that obviously from this perspective, it's a clear zechut for her, and so we should just take that umdana and presume that's what she's thinking, even though she's in front of us, saying she doesn't want to get a get.
That's right. But I also want, do you understand the circularity?
Wait, is the lahatiru below get talking about by giving a get zikoy, or is he saying because we can be matir him with heter merabanim?
Because we came out here without Hetzer Merabanim.
Wait, but is this again?
No, I think it's like because we can let him be married to two people at once.
Wait, but didn't we say that we don't let that? We only let him get divorced without her permission.
So I think what he says is that let's take in our case, Rav Moshe came out saying that in this case he believes that you don't need a Hetzer Merabanim in order to let him remarry.
This is for remarrying, not for...
For remarrying. I think, right, that's
the
whole case.
It's not for giving her divorce.
Right, okay, we don't
get to marry. But didn't he just say before that we don't love? In this case, it doesn't matter to us that he marries someone else. Because he's still going to be married to her, and she's us with her.
So in this case, that's why... Okay, so let's play that again. Ramosha's opening question is, Cohen married to a divorcee, can he marry somebody else? Right? That's his opening question.
Right.
And does he need a mayor about him? So his answer is, right at the end of the small print is, I think we can be samech l'arik that b'makom mitzvah where there's an iser, we don't require a mayor about him because, sorry, that's my fault. Okay. So, as he said, his answer is we can be some, but that the Malka Mitzvah we don't require Hetamei Rabbanim, in this case, against the Chsam Sofer. Right? That's his bottom line halacha in our case. When it's us, we don't require Mei Rabbanim.
No, but.
Yeah.
Is that for the divorce or that's for the remarriage?
For the remarriage. I think that's right. I think that's his end.
So, wait. Didn't we say something about how it doesn't matter to us if he gets remarried because she is still us or to him?
So he did say that at some point? According to one of his rationales.
Oh, but he doesn't agree with
that? But in the end, he doesn't follow that rationale. Yeah, I think that's correct.
He also throws in a concern. I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah. But he also throws in a concern that if... Once we permit him to marry without a get, we're worried that then he'll never agree to give her a get, even if she then later comes to us and wants a get.
Yes. Okay. Good. So that's right. I want to try and present the circularity first, and then let's talk about why he overrides the circularity. The circularity I'm trying to argue is, in the end, Rav Moshe's psak is, you can let this man remarry, but only if he gives his wife a get zikui.
Is the total lashon of chiyuv
here? Lashon of chiyuv. In practice, that's what he's going to do. He's going to say, let the man remarry, but only if he gives a get zikui. Now, why does he say that? Because the get zikui shouldn't work. The answer is, a get zikui does work because you could let him remarry without the get zikui. So you won't let him get remarried without the get zikui because you could let him get remarried without the get zikui, and therefore it's a schus. But if we said up front that you couldn't get married without the get zikui, then it wouldn't be a schus anymore. Right? You understand what that's circular?
Yes.
Okay, now why does Rav Moshe do that? He does that, as Josh points out correctly, because the consequence is that that if we allowed him to remarry in these circumstances without giving a get zikui, she's going to get stuck. And she's not going to be able to remarry at all. So the answer is, this I think is the revolution Rav Moshe cares about. But here's a case where she's Asura. We have no interest in them remaining married. She should take the get, and we still care about her. Right? The movement from, let's make sure that she suffers so that other women will learn not to do this, which is what we have in the Rishonim, right? The Veserna Nashim Achirat. We still have Maran Padua, right? That we're gonna let her be at Aguna forever, because that is right. Because that is the way in which we can prevent women from refusing Gittin. Two, let's make sure that he's Mezakeh a get to her, because otherwise, at some point, she may want the get, and she won't be free.
Or we don't say like Shatetet Batsi.
We don't say Halli Taylor or Shalvi Amot, right? You're right. So what's the easy rationale you can do this without being humane and sympathetic?
Yeah.
What's the easy way to explain this? Right? You don't have to be humane and sympathetic at all. Certainly not, God forbid, feminist.
We just want to reduce mom's zero.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Back then, the women we were punishing were frum. And so were the men around them. So if we made them agunas forever, they would just sit and be agunas forever and nothing bad would happen. But now, unfortunately, the women we're trying to punish have outsmarted us by being evil. And they will go off and get married to other people. And we'll have mamzerim, so we have not helped anything. So we will now, right? So we can't punish them now, because when we punish them, we're just punishing ourselves. Okay? But I think it's revolutionary. I think it's like a wholly different way of thinking about the halacha on these areas, that all of a sudden we have moved from trying to figure out how to deter to trying to figure out how we limit mamzerim. And if Rav Moshe has two, right, so he has two policy statements here. One is, there are cases where someone has a right to get divorced, but we still don't want them to. And we're going to try and set up barriers. Secondly, Rav Moshe is going to say there are places that people deserve to be agunot, but you know what? We're not going to let you do it. And those are both enormous, but along the way, he has really cool, really, really cool change. Okay, so let's skip now to Rav Moshe on 5721, which is page 31.
What page? 31.
Okay, so we've gotten past page 26, huh?
What is the number? Is the number the year?
Yes, number is the year. So we're 5 years left. 5721, then we're in the...
1961.
50, right? We're 56 years ago. Yeah, 61. The first tshuva was 56. These tshuva are both are all these tshuva already for Rav Moshe as a fairly, you know, as a fairly mature posik. These are not tshuvas from, you know, when he's 30. Right? These are tshuvas when he's ready. Rav Moshe was born in 1896, I think, said, right? So the first of these tshuvas is Rav Moshe's already 60. And now he's 65.
1961.
Yeah. Or thereabouts, 61 or 62, right? It's Tevet. Yeah, 61.
Right? 21 years after 1945.
Yeah. Okay.
That's kind of, I like orient myself by 1940.
So here, now we've gone into the straightforward modern case of Isha Shinisgarsha Be'arkos Ve'eno Rotze L'Kabel Gidas Moshe B'Yisrael. Straightforward case of Misarevet. Okay, so the person he's writing to, Rabbi Trebnik, says the following. The Ramah says that if you gave a woman a pasul get, and then it, right, and she accepted it, and then she tried to change her mind. She can't change her mind anymore. You can divorce her anyway. So if that works, so right. So the Rabbi Trebnik says, right. We saw the Rama. Rabbi Trebnik says, so what that really means is, once she's given consent to divorce, she can't remove it. And when she consents to divorce in civil court, that counts as consent.
So we should be able. So once someone gets a divorce in civil court, we should be able to appoint a shliach and, like, throw a get at her.
Yes.
And that will divorce her against her will.
Yes.
And this will prevent mamzer.
It will prevent igun.
And igun.
Prevent igun, right? Igun, right? Men, right? Men. This will eliminate women's blackmail possibility. Once the civil divorce is final, women can't stop the religious divorce anymore. And the truth is, that's a very reasonable svara. Right? You want to be divorced. It all depends on what you think the rationale was for the gzera. But it's a very reasonable argument to say, you only get right. Either you want to be divorced or you don't. Here, you plainly want to be divorced. So why should we have a takana that prevents you, right? That lets you blackmail somebody. Okay. Here's Rav Moshe's response. Hinei. Right, so if you look, the Rabbi Trebnik's position is summed up in the bold letters. He says, "L'chein gam shenisgarsha barkos, af shaladina einu klum, mikol makom kaven shasta masel he pard mi bala v'choshevus es atzmen lebigureshes asmenu v'einu rotze klal lachzer levala she'od kol shekein minimsa get pasul shenischarta." Right, so it's a really yeah, I give Rabbi Trebnik all the credit. This is a straightforward, brilliant argument that should carry the day.
Pretty good svara, even if public policy results are a little weird.
So now I have to figure out.